So I'm joined again by Phil Oakley for this week's IC Alpha podcast. How are you doing, Phil?
Yeah, I'm all right. Thank you, John. Are you all right?
I'm very well, thank you. I'm here on holiday in Southwold, but taking a break from my holiday to talk about the markets and some action on the reporting front, which you've updated in your Alpha report this week. Should we talk about the markets? I mean, I must admit, I haven't really been paying a lot of attention. Quickly had a look at the FTSE All Share chart, and it's pretty ugly. What's going on?
Well, there's lots going on. But I think I think there's a bit of reality starting to kick in to investor mindsets now, in that this situation that we find ourselves in with the virus and the restrictions that are put on our way of lives are here for a long time, or potentially a long time, and that has big implications on how we all behave, how we spend money, and how businesses earn money. And it's quite clear that for a lot of businesses, it's going to be very, very hard.
Yeah, so looking at the chart, the latest sort of drop came after the 15th of September, I guess, when worries about rising infection rates and potential second lockdowns started to emerge. And I guess this is something you've been talking about for a long time, that the possibility of this second wave was dismissed quite widely and markets went on a big run. But now it looks like, as you say, it's becoming a reality. What are the implications of this in terms of how the economy is affected?
I think the risk is that the economy, having had, you know, basically punched in the guts in March, has got back on its feet and actually done quite a good job of trying to recover over the summer, and, you know, getting to where we are now. And the danger is that it stalls again, and we get, you know, another leg down in economic activity. You know, if you actually look at read what companies are coming out and saying, you know, we're getting a lot of company results now, which is incredibly useful if you take the time to read them, because you do get a feel of what's actually going on at the coalface by looking at all different companies. And a lot of companies coming out and saying, look, you know, there's still a lot of uncertainty out there. And particularly sectors like leisure, hospitality, sadly, they're laying people off. And if you lay people off, that means that people will have less money to spend, and it will affect the economy.
We spoke to a number of businesses for our other podcast, Not Your Normal Finance Show, this week. And, you know, they've spent a lot of money trying to get themselves into a position where they can start to operate again in an environment with COVID-19. And, you know, that money could potentially be wasted if, you know, all of a sudden harsh new restrictions come in and they can't trade.
Yeah, I mean, the pubs, I've thought for a long time that the pubs are going to really struggle. I think that the pubs have been fortunate in some way in that the weather in the summer has been so good that customers who have come back to the pubs have been able to sit outside and drink outside, and that's been very helpful. And once the weather changes and things get, you know, the nights get darker, it's going to be a lot harder. And things like the 10 o'clock curfew that's being announced is a real killer, particularly for the sort of city centre bars, which are where you've had a polarisation of trading activity, which happened years ago, into Friday and Saturday nights. You know, if these things are having to close at 10 o'clock, which means last orders is at 9:30, it's going to be very tough. And that feeds through. You know, the whole, you know, it's times like this that you actually get to see how things work. Things are actually laid out very clearly for you. And you realise that the economy is just millions and millions of linked activities. And if all you need is something in the chain to get weaker or to break, and the whole system comes under stress.
And it seems like right now lots of things are breaking at the same time, sadly, with this common denominator of COVID-19.
Yeah, and then, you know, and there's all, you know, there's things like, you know, the furlough scheme. And we had, you know, we had the Chancellor yesterday coming out and saying, how it's quite clear the government cannot afford to pay 80% of people's wages indefinitely. And it's you know, we've had the debt figures come out. We're talking Friday morning now. You know, debt figures have come out this morning, and I think last month, the government borrowed £36 billion. It cannot keep doing that, despite the fanciful thoughts of certain academics that you can just print your way out of trouble. That's just fantasy. You cannot keep doing that. You know, with the new scheme going forward, it's only going to support jobs that are there, jobs that are viable. And, you know, it's quite clear that the Chancellor is saying that a lot of jobs are now unviable. This is a, you know, potentially very big shock to spending power in the economy. And, you know, it's often said that the stock market isn't the economy, which is true. Or the economy isn't the stock market, whichever way you want to put it. That's true, but the economy does have a big bearing on company revenues and company profits. And when it comes to share prices, they matter.
You would think that what happens in the real economy has to filter through to the stock market at some point. I've always been puzzled by this. Yeah, they don't move in lockstep, the economy and markets, but as you say, companies are reporting profits. Those profits drive their valuations. The valuations drives the share price. So the market overall. So I really don't understand how people can be so blasé about disconnecting the economy and the stock market. They have to be somehow connected.
I agree. Eventually they have to. But obviously, the Federal Reserve tried to do a very good job at convincing people that that's not true, and that all you need to do is print money, screw down interest rates, and the price of everything goes up. And that really does have limits. I mean, it looks now, you know, if you believe that, as I do, that what happens in America basically affects what happens here in terms of stock markets, time will tell. But the American market looks like it's plateaued. But one of the other interesting things I've seen, you know, in the last week or so, which I find quite telling, is we seem to have moved from people being obsessed about inflation and perhaps a dawning reality that we're not going to get inflation, despite things like supply shocks being caused by factories being shut and money being printed. The demand shock of people being out of work is actually stronger. So you haven't got, and also the fact that the money that the Federal Reserve is printing, most of it isn't going into the pockets of households, for starters. So you haven't got that classic scenario of too much money chasing too few goods. The real worry is actually that what we're seeing now is a big deflationary effect. And if you just look at the price of things like gold and silver, which are seen as classic inflation hedges, they sold off very strongly in the last 3, 4, 5 weeks, suggesting that the fear of inflation is not there at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, you are seeing inflation in some asset classes. We've written about property and house prices on the cover feature of the magazine this week. I'm down in Southwold, and this property market here is going ballistic. I guess partly that's people trying to escape London, but you know, now that we're in this new teleworking world, but you know, we're looking at these houses thinking, how long is this going to last? Is there a sort of mania which is driving some asset prices up in the short term? We've spoken to local business people who've said we can't get staff, so there is some wage cost inflation that they're feeling around here. So I don't know. There are sort of some inflationary signs, but maybe they're red herrings.
No, I agree with the point you've made about property. I think the next podcast is that we need to go into London and talk to a London estate agent and find out who's buying the property that Londoners are selling.
Yeah, because they've got to sell their properties there to buy the ones here. So I think this is where the chain perhaps falls down a little bit. But we should talk about that at another time in more detail. Yeah. Should we talk about some companies this week that are reflective of what's happening in the COVID economy? I think you wanted to start in with, should we start with the bad news and finish with the good news?
Yeah.
That seems the most potentially uplifting way to address this sticky subject. Should we start with SSP, which had some numbers this week, and is struggling very badly.
Struggling very badly, and it's amazing. You know, a year ago, if you and I were sitting down and talking about this company a year ago, or even slightly less than a year ago, we'd probably come to the view that, you know, you wouldn't mind having a few shares in a company like this because, you know, you have shops, you run shops on railway forecourts and airports, lots of captive customers, lots of throughput, growing passenger numbers, who can come and spend in your shops, and you can make quite nice profits, quite nice returns on them, and there was a pipeline of lots more to come, and now there isn't. And you know, the numbers that we've seen this week are, you know, just horrendous. You know, you're looking at like sales levels down sort of 85%, and massive losses. Now, this company is, you know, made £220 million of trading profit last year, and it's going to make a loss of about £210 if things go for them, go the way they think they're going to go.
There's a massive swing.
That is a massive swing, and but it's actually better than what they thought it might have been 3 months ago. This company's worked really quite hard and deserves a lot of credit. It's really worked hard on its cash flow, its cost, renegotiating its rent, but it's still burning cash. You know, cash is still flowing out the door every month, and only around a third of its outlets are still open. So, you know, how does this company get back to making what it made in 2019? Is impossible to say. You know, the air traffic forecasts are not sort of to get back to 2019 levels until about 2024. And I think that on the rail business, certainly in this country, you can't help thinking that people working from home, and a lot of them like it, and whilst a lot of them will probably go back to the office in some way, they may not do it 5 days a week. So you can't help thinking that there's been some permanent damage to the value of SSP's rail business here.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, there must have been some hope when the government was encouraging workers to go back to offices, which was only a few weeks ago. And now that the reverse seems to be very true. And I've heard stories of people who were back in the office who've now been told, actually, don't come in for a bit. And then you've got the curfew. I mean, you know, the SSP model is based on these sort of rail franchises. Get your late night pasty after a trip to the pub. That's gone too. And who knows when that's coming back. So, yeah, I think this is a very, very troubled company. And you might look at it and say, wow, it's cheap. You know, it was a great business. Could be a great business again. But I don't think you're so sure.
The debt levels now. You know, particularly when you take into account that this is a company that rents its shops, so it has lease obligations, and it's done, as I say, it's done some good work in trying to contain the risks of its obligations there. But there's a lot of debt in this business, and that debt is going up whilst the company is losing money.
But I guess it's bankers, you know, if that debt's going up, they don't want it to reach the point where it just simply cannot pay it back. So presumably its bankers will give it quite a lot of support here, or can we expect another rights issue, or, you know, yeah. So somebody's got, if it cannot recover trading to pay back its debt, or to at least get its debt under control, then, you know, it seems like a business that nobody will want to let go bust.
Yeah, I think if people can see a recovery and see a reasonably strong recovery in profits, then this is the kind of business that you will lend money to, whether you're a banker or a shareholder. I think don't rule off these kind of travel and hospitality businesses having to ask shareholders for more money again. No one's really talking about this. They seem to have. You know, got their fundraisings away, some of them quite well, and done a good job of it.
SSP was a very early fundraising as well, if I remember.
Yeah, I mean, they, you know, they were raising what doing placings of 20% of their shares, which is usually something that annoys shareholders, existing shareholders, but, you know, needs must. You know, it may well have to happen again before these businesses get on a more sounder footing. Let's hope they're done. But if you're an analyst or an investor looking at a stock like this, how on earth do you have any confidence that you can predict the profits and therefore value a business like this? It's really hard.
Pure punt, in other words. Should we talk about Whitbread as well, which is another company that is obviously in the travel sector and hospitality sector, which is having a very, very similar experience, which you've written about in your Alpha report this week. In particular, the hotels business, I think, is perhaps something we should talk about because, yeah, not a lot of people have talked about the hotel industry throughout COVID. And Whitbread and its Premier Inn subsidiary are suffering for two very different reasons here in the hotels business. Talk us through what's going on.
Well, you know, before COVID came around, you know, I would say that this company had probably the best hotel business in the UK. I mean, a lot of us have stayed in Premier Inns. I mean, I've not stayed in one for a while, but over the years, I've stayed in quite a lot of them. And I think from a customer point of view, they're pretty good businesses. And they have rolled them out very aggressively, the number of hotels and hotel rooms across the UK. And they've taken a lot of market share from the sort of independent hotel operators that haven't got the money and resources to keep their hotels looking nice and welcoming to particularly business people in midweek, but also the sort of domestic weekend away holiday market as well.
Yeah, they're the two aspects that I think. I mean, they're slightly different, but each of them are affected in different ways by what's happening, the tourism side of things, but also the business travel side of things.
Yeah, the tourism side of it, up until what's sort of been happening this week, looks like it's come back quite well. And you know, one of the key things that you look at with a hotel is how full its hotels are, the occupancy rate. And the occupancy rate in hotels with, you know, good tourist demand, not talking about London here at the moment because London is not benefiting from tourist demand, is about 80%. That's pretty good. The rest of it is pretty bad, and that the overall occupancy rate is about 50%. So these hotels are half full, which means that a lot of business areas are less than half full. And essentially, you can't make money as a hotelier with occupancy levels like that. You've still got a lot of fixed costs to cover. And you need, you know, 70% plus, really, to start, not just start making decent profits, but actually getting a return on investment of the millions and millions that you have to invest in a business like this. And Whitbread looks like it's a long way from doing this, and it's having to take pretty radical action. And you're talking about 6,000 jobs going in this business over the next few months, and also those that have jobs maybe have to work fewer hours, more flexible hours, as the whole business model has to change and adapt to a different world.
So I think it's quite interesting. I mean, you talk about business meetings. I mean, this could be a permanent shift. You know, people have not travelled on business in the way they did. Now they realise that actually they don't have to travel in the way that they did to conduct business. Premier Inns invested a lot of money to capitalise on the business travel market. Does it have to write down a lot of its assets now?
I think it's going to have to write down its assets. I mean, you know, in the good times, you know, people will look, even people like me saying, look, this is a company that's got a lot of really valuable assets. And, you know, particularly in places like London, and there's a lot of freehold property value here. And I've been banging on for years that Whitbread should have done what Intercontinental Hotels had done, which was actually sell off the assets and turn Premier Inn into a franchising system. I don't think you can do that now. I think if you look at asset value, you know, a lot of investors look at asset value and they say, oh yeah, they compare the price of the share with the asset value per share. I think the important thing to realize when you're looking at asset values is that the asset value is only worth what it's stated at is in the book if that asset can earn a reasonable return, you know, in terms of profit and cash flow. Now, if we look at the forecasts, we're quite lucky. We, you know, if I look at the, you know, the 4-week forecasts for profits and asset values that analysts have put out for Whitbread, you know, even in 3 years' time, analysts have basically got Whitbread making less than 5% return on equity on, you know, a net asset value of about $4.5 billion. That tells me, and the market cap at the moment is just over $4 billion. That's kind of telling me that unless they pick up to sort of 8-9% minimum, those assets are not worth $4.5 billion. They're worth a lot less. And, you know, it wouldn't surprise me that come sort of March next year or the spring next year when the company produces annual accounts, it's going to have to put a lot of red ink through the value of its hotels.
Yeah, and presumably the cost of running those hotels on top of the lower revenue that it's getting, presumably with all that extra capacity, its room rates are you know, perhaps not holding up as well as they could be as well, you would imagine. Speaking to, you know, people that run the holiday lets around here, there are all sorts of extra costs involved in cleaning and making everything COVID safe. So as well as this revenue hit, there must be a cost hit as well here for a business like this, which is not going to go away.
Yeah, definitely. And the interesting thing is that, you know, there's been no mention of room rate, you know. What, you know, one of the ways you can fill up rooms is you cut the room rate. And now my concern now with Whitbread is that in certain markets, you know, it in particular has been throwing a load of fresh supply at this market. And the sort of nagging thing that I've got in the back of my mind with this company is that in certain sections of the UK market, certain towns and locations, it may have got too many rooms and the market itself may be oversupplied. Time will tell.
Sounds like one to avoid for the time being. Should we
I think so.
Should we talk about something positive? Now that we've had the depressive effect of COVID. Let's talk about small fluffy animals because they always cheer everyone up. Pets at Home had a little trading update yesterday and it was, as you would expect, given that everyone is buying puppies, really pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, we talked about this a few weeks ago, didn't we, as a sort of possible private equity success story. Mm. Eventually. But clearly, you know, pets are actually a very interesting investment theme in general because humans treat pets better than they treat each other. Trying to invest in something that helps do that can be quite a good way to invest your money. And, you know, Pets at Home have done a pretty good job. You know, their strategy, it's not just these big stores on retail parks where you walk out with a bag of dog food under your arm. You know, they have vet surgeries, grooming parlours, that kind of thing. And they've done really well with it. And
it's taken them a while to get it right, though. I mean, it has taken a while. They did have a few missteps after they came to market, a few little twists and turns, refining that strategy, but now it looks in pretty good shape.
Yeah, this is a recent event. You know, it's taken them a while to find this strategy that works, and it's working pretty well now. And, you know, profits, momentum in profits is heading in the right direction, which is an interesting theme in itself because I think we've got a piece either on our website or in the magazine this week, which is looking at companies that are seeing a lot of upgrades. And I think it's on the website, actually.
Yeah, that would be part of the Ideas Farm that LG Hall puts together.
Yeah, and this is a really interesting piece to go and look at because I was actually taken aback by... the size of the list. You know, and obviously Pets is part of this. You're getting companies coming out and saying that, you know, things are going to be a bit better than what they expected, or a lot better than what they expected. This can be quite interesting if that trend continues, because these shares can become momentum shares, subject to what we said about 10, 15 minutes ago about what's happening with the economy. You obviously got to be mindful of that. The other thing to bear in mind is that even though these things are getting better, they're still, so in many cases, they're still a long way away from what they were a year ago. And when it comes to valuation and things like that, these companies still have a lot of work to do. But it's an interesting theme that I think investors should keep an eye on. And Pets at Home is definitely part of this.
I mean, it has had, unlike Whitbread and SSP, a COVID tailwind. So, I joked about people rushing out as lockdown hit to buy pets, but they did. The numbers support that. You know, dog sales and dog prices went through the roof. And, you know, once you've invested in a dog, in a cockapoo or whatever it might be, you've got to keep paying for it. So there is a sort of, there does seem to be some kind of resilience to the revenue streams of a company like Pets at Home. You can't stop feeding it. You can't stop taking it to the vet, giving it its injections or whatever it might be.
Absolutely. You know, it's pretty much, you know, non-discretionary. It's very, these businesses are actually very defensive. And, you know, we've seen, you know, over the last decade, investors like reliable, dependable, understandable businesses. And this ticks a lot of boxes.
Yeah, and presumably there's a bit of potential growth in there as well. You know, if the pet market continues to grow, then as well as that sort of, as you say, non-discretionary, dependable revenue stream, you've also got potentially a bigger market to serve as more people rush out and buy dogs as we go into second lockdown.
Yeah, hopefully people have still got the money to buy the dog food.
Yeah, let's hope so. Okay, let's move on to another positive story, which is Diploma. It's an interesting little business, and as you say in your Alpha report, it's in distribution, which is not something we generally like, but there are some very good examples, and this is one of them.
Yeah, I mean, you know, distributors, you know, buying and selling stuff is often and quite rightly seen as a sort of low value added activity. But there are examples out there where companies do it very well. Bunzl, which is a company we talked about a few weeks ago, is one that does a good job. And Diploma is another one. And what makes Diploma very interesting is that, unlike Bunzl, which is selling and distributing sort of lots of everyday items like cleaning materials and things like packaging, Diploma is very niche. It is focusing on a lot of sort of specialist problem solving applications. So it's selling things like medical devices, cables, and selling into markets like mobile machinery, defense, aerospace, very specialist critical products that are needed by its customers for their businesses to work properly. The other thing as well is they are selling stuff that is part of their customers' day-to-day activities. It's not like big investment projects that can be cancelled. It's stuff that businesses need day-to-day to keep running. So it's not the sort of thing that they can turn off very quickly or very easily, without disrupting their own business. And what Diploma is a brilliant example of as well, and this is a theme that you keep coming back to when you're trying to identify outstanding businesses, is how the company forges relationships with its supply chain, but more importantly, its customers. So I've talked about the past companies like Spirax Sarco, which for me is one of the best examples of a business that really, really gets to know its customer, gets to know what it needs, and becomes a partner in making its customers' businesses better That is a fantastic attribute for a business to have, and it helps it grow profitably. Diploma has a lot of this also. And what it's been able to do is get in with its customers who are in attractive end markets, selling profitable products to it and growing. And then on top of that, it's then been buying companies that they can add on to this existing system of businesses that they've got, and then they scale it up and leverage it up. And this has been a phenomenally successful strategy, has been for Bunzl, has been even better for Diploma. And this week we saw a very, very big acquisition that the stock market seemed to like, and even I was taken aback by how much the share price went up. But having looked at this deal, you almost have to look back at it and think, goodness me, this is almost too good to be true. You know, it's an acquisition that just sounds brilliant, which kind of sort of makes me a little bit wary. But if I look at it, it just thinks, well, yeah, I can understand why people like this.
It's also, you'd imagine, people interpret it as a show of confidence from Diploma in its ability to keep finding these kind of deals, keep growing in what for many companies is a very difficult time.
Well, I think there was a lot of confidence. Yeah, there was a lot of confidence. Certainly investors were very confident as well. I mean, if you looked at so they're buying this business in America, which is a big distributor of low voltage cables, which the business is booming at the moment because they're selling a lot of stuff into things like data centers for cloud computing and things like 5G mobile networks. Big growth businesses that are likely to be growing strongly for a long time. And the business that they've bought, it's called Windy City, has had a fantastic track record of growing. And it seems to me that Diploma have been able to get this for a phenomenally good price, which I just think either the seller's been completely fleeced or there's something here that's just too good to be true. But you see, it's a £357 million price tag to this. And the company have raised £190 million in a placing. And then they, to their credit, they went on primary bid and gave private investors a chance to put some money in as well. And they raised £4 million from them. And they were able to do it at hardly any discount, you know, or not much of a discount to the prevailing price. And yeah, it just looks really good. I mean, the deal is going to make a very good return on investment. It is adding a significant chunk in revenue and profit to Diploma's existing business. So it's making Diploma a much bigger business, but it's making it a bigger business in its controls market, which is a very attractive business, as I've just given you a couple of big growth drivers there, and also in the American market as well. So you look at this and people are like ticking boxes and ticking boxes and saying, yep, like this, like the price, like the growth, like the ability to sort of scale this. And you know, the share price went up, what, 25, 26% or whatever it was.
Not sure I like the rating too much, 34 times earnings. I mean, it's pretty punchy.
Yeah, no one likes that kind of price, do they?
No, not really. But I guess, yeah, we've talked about this many, many times before. You've got to pay up for quality.
This is the going rate now.
This is the going rate.
Now, we may in the future come back and say, what on earth were we talking about saying that this was the going rate when it does look, you know, for people like you and me who have been around a bit and looked at valuations over 20 odd years, this looks ridiculous. But we are in a world of low interest rates and a scarcity of quality growth stories. And this is, as you say, this is the price. But I think that's pre-upgrade. So it was on about 34 times earnings yesterday before the upgrades to forecast came through. But yeah, this is a really good business in something that a lot of people may may initially dismiss.
And it's in your UK quality shares portfolio.
It is. I haven't been doing that well until this week, so yeah. it's bailed it out.
Excellent. Well, cheers, Phil. You going to join me in Southold next week? Do the podcast from up here?
I'll see what the weather's like, John.
It's looking pretty dodgy at the moment, to be honest. I think the weather forecast is rain for the next week. I've timed it brilliantly. But at least I'm not in London.
If it's anything like today, I'm staying put. But if it's all right, then I'll be putting the back seats down on my car and filling up at Adnams Brewery on the way back.
Fabulous. Thanks, Phil. Speak to you next week.
Thanks, John.